Tonight, we are delighted to welcome editors of and contributors to She's Such a Geek, bringing together a diverse range of critical and personal essays about the meaning of female nerdhood by women who are in love with genomics, obsessed with blogging, learned about sex and Dungeons and Dragons, and aren't afraid to match wits with men or computers. Such a Geek celebrates women who have flourished in the male-dominated realms of technical and of the technical and cultural arcane. Without further ado, I present the editors of She's Such a Geek.
Well, thanks for coming out tonight. Last week we had a lineup of geeks who were all basically in fandom, and tonight we have more science and technology oriented geeks. So we didn't purposely segregate them, but that's happening. So before we get started, Charlie and I are just going to talk a little bit about sort of the germ of the idea that led to this book and why we wanted to publish a book that was basically all about what it means to be a female geek. We have sort of, you know, at a certain point, Charlie and I were at a conference in New York a couple of years ago that we will not name, but it was a hacker conference in New York. And I was on stage presenting a paper along with another woman, and I was introduced by the MC. We were both introduced as the only two chicks at the conference. And so I should have responded more gracefully than I did. I actually stood up and flipped the guy off. The other woman was much more graceful about it and refrained from doing that. But the sort of incident solidified for both of us. Charlie was there in the audience, and there were many, many women in the audience, and I could see as I was looking out at them, you know, what his comment did to their faces. I mean, all of them sort of got this look like, okay, we've heard that fucking joke before. We felt like, you know, one of the problems with a lot of geeky culture is that there's this kind of myth that everyone in that culture is a guy. And what that does is it means that the women who are there get kind of erased, and not only are their contributions ignored for sort of old school traditional, you know, reasons to do with sexism, but really just because people aren't expecting to see them. And so their voices aren't heard and they're not seen. And so we really felt after that experience and countless others was that we wanted a book where women said, hey, you know, not only are we here, we've been here for ages, there's more and more of us all the time, and we're totally nerds, and we want to talk about it, and we want to come out and be as geeky as possible, and not, you know, let you forget that, in fact, there are not just two chicks at the conference, there's a ton of chicks at the conference, and we're all geeking out with you. So
when Seal Press asked us to do a book, one of the things that they wanted to know is, you know, when we suggested She's Such a Geek, they were like, well, what are the other books that have been done on this subject? Because they wanted to publish, they wouldn't want to publish the book unless it was like, there were other books that had already been published that they could point to and say, look, there's a whole genre of She's Such a Geek books. There's like a whole type of book about female geeks. And so, you know, we went on Amazon and Google and we searched, and you know, there was like one book from like 1992 that was like an academic book, and then there was also like this book called Geek Girl that came out a few years ago. Has anybody ever seen Geek Girl? Supposedly it sold like two copies, literally. It was like a picture book. It had a picture on the cover of like this cute young hipster girl wearing glasses, and it had inside it was like pictures with little aphorisms like, you're a geek girl if you shop at Amazon.com. I bought it used, so at least I didn't contribute at all to like the geek girl steamroller. So that was like the only book that had been published in the last decade about female geeks. So, you know, then we put out our call for submissions, and we were just astonished at the response we got. We got hundreds of submissions, but also, you know, it was blogged at Boing Boing and StarWars.com and Canadian Public Radio had something about it, and it was just like, you know, people were so excited because they'd been waiting for a long time for this, and we were like, yay!
Yeah, not just female geeks, but also male geeks, too, were really excited, and were like, yes, finally, you know, like, my girlfriend or my friend or whatever can talk about it.
Or my mom.
Or my mom. Actually, a lot of people talked about their moms. And so, basically, we got you know, this huge amount of submissions. And so we kind of wanted to narrow down what we meant by geek a little bit. So by geek in this book, what we mean are basically people who are interested in sort of technical or scientific or cultural arcana or sort of obscure areas in technology and culture. So, you know, there's people who are interested in fandom, people who do Harry Potter role-playing games, as well as physicists and bioinformaticians and technologists of various types. And also, all of these areas of culture and science are still male-dominated, some more than others. And so part of the mission of the book as well is to talk about what it's like to be somebody who is in, you know, a woman who's in an area where male tend to dominate. So do we want to say anything else? Or let's just start geeking. So our first, I'm just going to use the copy. Our first reader tonight is Kristen Odkemeyer. She has a PhD in experimental condensed matter physics and now is working in information technology development and is a writer and artist, and she has a blog at radioactivebanana.com, which is like my favorite name ever. So why don't you come on up?
Lately, I've been blogging more as she's such a geek. Okay, well, I'll just start from the start. How did I start on the path to becoming a geek? So, being from job security. Major in math or science. That way you'll always have a job, my mother told me. I was 9 years old, and we were driving back to our suburban Chicago home after a shopping trip to the mall. English majors are a dime a dozen. You'll have less competition for good jobs if you can handle math. I was a sensitive, skinny girl with cropped, mousy blonde hair and plastic granny glasses. As a girl of the 1970s, I was told repeatedly about how wonderful it was that I could do anything I wanted for a career and not be limited to the options of nurse, secretary, or teacher. My mother underscored this message by telling me how her parents hadn't encouraged her in math and science. She wanted me to have the confidence that she lacked in those areas. I was sorry to hear that English wasn't worth considering, though. Although I was very good at math, I also loved reading stories. Everything from Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, to the Great Brain series, with its clever boy pranks. I also drew constantly and took countless arts and crafts classes, but my mother made it clear that art was no way to make a living. That's still true, actually. Despite all this pressure, I might never have traveled quite so far down the geek road if it had not been for my classmate, John Frisch, whose mother was friends with my mother. My mom and Mrs. Frisch had found each other a few years earlier when John was the only kindergartner besides me who could already read. Together, they made sure that we got to take reading classes with the first graders. Our mothers tried to pass their friendship along to us, but on the only play date we ever had, I ended up soaked in water and tears after they invited me to look at a bright ring and then used it to squirt water right into my eye. My mom made me invite John to my 6th birthday party anyway, and he continued to be a tangential part of my life. After my parents moved my brothers and me to local Catholic schools, my mom still kept in touch with Mrs. Frisch. It seemed like each time they talked, I would hear afterward about what clever advanced project Wonder Boy John was doing that night. Then in the spring of 6th grade, I got sucked into their little competition. It all started when Mom and I were in the car, driving the Saturday morning suburban errand circuit. I was talking to Mrs. Frisch, and she said that John took the SAT, she said casually. It's a test normally given to high school seniors, but he took it because there's a special math program that's using the SAT as an entrance exam. John scored well enough that he will be taking high school level math in the 7th grade next year. I got the information from Mrs. Frisch, and I want you to take the test. My mom's tone implied that this was a settled matter. My gut tightened like it always did when John's name came up. But why? Is this something I have to study for? You wouldn't make me take that class, right? My mother reassured me. No, it's nothing to study for. I just want to see how you do, that's all. You probably won't even qualify anyway. I was torn between feeling hurt that she just assumed that John was smarter and worried that I might end up in this weird class with extra homework. I sighed and slouched in my seat, knowing that I had no choice. Whatever happened, I did not want to take any extra math class, and especially not with John Frisch. My school gave the test to several of the strongest math students in my class. I was the only one from that group to qualify, just like John,
scoring just a little better than an average 12th grader on the math portion of the SAT. Of course, the test wasn't the end of the story. My parents frog marched me to an information session about the math course a couple of weeks later. On our way in, we spied the Fishes, and I waved a polite hello, even though it was their fault I was even at the speaking session. Mr. Field and Mr. Geis, the instructors for the program, explained how there would be a two-hour class every Monday and Wednesday evening, and extensive problem sets due each week. If we enrolled, that is. Which, of course, I was not going to do. So how many of you think you'll be joining us? Mr. Field asked for a show of hands. Mine remained tucked under my armpits. Extra homework? No way. But my parents picked up the enrollment forms. We're signing you up. You're not being challenged enough in your math class at school, my mother said. And I've already talked to Mrs. Frisch about carpooling.
Is Jessica here?
Okay.
So our next reader is going to be the awesome Ellen Spertus. And
Charlotte. Okay. Ellen Spertus is an associate professor of computer science at Mills College, where she directs the graduate program in interdisciplinary computer science. She is also a part-time software engineer at Google. She has numerous technical publications in computer architecture, information retrieval, and online communities, and has written for Technology Review, Chronicle of Higher Education, Glamour, and Odyssey. She lives in San Francisco. Please welcome Ellen Spertus.
Thank you, Charlie. They changed the title of my article. I wanted it to be from male identified misogynist to sexiest people alive. Although I've been a geek all my life and am now a computer science professor at a women's college, I wasn't always a feminist. I used to be a male-identified misogynist. I grew up in an upper-middle-class Jewish family dominated intellectually by my father, an MIT graduate. Next in line was my brother Michael, a mathematics prodigy. And then there was me, who took to computers like a sponge to water. The best way to retain my status and self-respect in our family was to act like a male and disdain anything feminine. I felt I had little in common with my housewife mother and older sister Debbie, whom I considered not very smart or interesting. After all, they weren't good at math and science. I once asked my little sister, Andrea, if she thought of me more as a brother or a sister, and she responded, "I think of you as a sibling." My mother, on the other hand, didn't know what to think of me. She had earned her position in life by attracting a wealthy husband, and she considered conspicuous intelligence incompatible with femininity. My brother, who was otherwise encouraging, teaching me math and telling me inspiring stories, told me about the theory that mathematical ability was correlated with testosterone, and that the best modern female mathematician was extremely ugly. I concluded that women in science were necessarily unfeminine. I also felt that female scientists were lacking, not just as women, but as scientists. While I was easily the top girl at math in school, at least until MIT, there were always boys smarter than me. I remember telling my high school friends that I judged the difficulty of a class by how few girls were in it. My brother was a constant example of male superiority, locally famous for mathematical achievements that I was never able to match. I concluded that the best woman would never be as good as the best man. The best she could hope for was to associate herself with the biggest genius. When I began dating, I chose men who were brilliant at science, regardless of their other qualities. In high school, I dated the boy with a top score on the national math exam. I was the highest scoring girl. I gushed to him at prom that of all the couples there, we had the highest combined national math. At MIT, see, I dated even higher scores. Although fortunately, I got over my obsession with intelligence at a young enough age not to become a Nobel Prize winner sperm bank. Despite my prejudices, I wanted to meet another girl like myself. I went to one of the first computer camps in 1981, where the male-to-female ratio was about 6-1. I was the only girl in the top class, and I told an InfoWorld reporter that I was disappointed there weren't more girls. In my first, but not last, Mediumist quote, he wrote that I was disappointed there weren't more boys.
So the title that we gave her essay was Professor in a Circuit Board Corset, and you can see why. So our next reader is Jen Shreve. Do you guys want to come in here? There's some seats in the street for a month later. Okay. Jen Shreve's love of science and technology makes its way into both her fiction and nonfiction. Her work has appeared in Slate, Seed, Wired, Ready Made, and the San Francisco Chronicle, among others. She lives in San Francisco, and you can find her online at jenshreve.com. All right, welcome, Jen Shreve.
I use science and technology to make it bigger. If it took me nearly 2 decades to finally discover my passion for science and technology, it was because up until then I had only the vaguest idea of what these things really were. In the fundamentalist Christian schools I attended growing up, they force-fed us not the watered-down intelligent design version of science education, but the rich, meaty, biblical variety. Complete with side dishes on why evolutionists were a bunch of liars and their science full of phony baloney. It was a very confusing state of affairs. One day, in accordance with state guidelines, we'd be taught the scientific method. Observe, hypothesize, predict, experiment. The next, we were being told that the famous scientists like Albert Einstein had used that very same method to further Satan's agenda. The science we learned required skepticism and critical thinking. In Bible class, however, we were informed that questioning God's ways was moral rebellion. And in case you were a doubting Thomas, my early teachers applied plenty of scientific sound arguments for why carbon dating and Darwin were shams. The science I'd encountered had barely been science at all. No wonder it often left a strange taste in my mouth. And my technology didn't care about us either. She was viewed by many of my teachers and church leaders as witchcraft. Mess around too much with those computers and you might just... And you might just wind up with evil voodoo in your soul. ATM cards weren't just a convenient way to get money out of the bank. They harbored the underlying technology that would soon facilitate the dreaded mark of the beast. Select quick cash, and you might as well be casting your vote for the Antichrist. Or so the thinking went. But technology came to the rescue. But when technology came to the rescue in form of medicine or satellite channel devoted entirely to the gospel, then those around me would call it a miracle, as though God had the hottest R&D outfit in all of Silicon Valley. But all of this was besides the point, because I was a girl. Thanks to feminism, women of my mother's generation were indeed becoming astronauts, science, computer scientists, surgeons, engineers, architects, but as a young missionette, a Christian alternative to Girl Scouts, I completed detailed workshops on proper posture, which didn't learn very well, and the polite way to serve dinner. Lessons from the Bible emphasized service, not success, and the message was clear. Christian women were destined to serve God and husband and to bear children and raise them full time. And I had no reason to doubt it. The women who lived in the California agricultural town where I grew up were moms, house cleaners, babysitters, secretaries, and teachers. They were really into their vacuum cleaners and dry flower arrangements, and they were never physicists, doctors, or even farmers. In spite of all this, my inner geek managed to shine through in small ways.
If the consistently high test scores in science and math weren't obvious enough, my addiction to Pac-Man, Moon Patrol, Centipede, Space Invaders, and the early text-based version of Oregon Trail, where you had to type "bang" as quickly as possible or get eaten by a bear, were dead giveaways. There was also my preternatural ability to navigate the awkward user interfaces of our 1980s era consumer electronics without ever needing to RTFM. The Blue Ribbon Science Fair project in 7th grade, the award in high school chemistry. When it came time to dissect the frog in software biology, I was the first in line. Given the opportunity to the same to a small black cat in college, I bought a scalpel and enrolled in anatomy. I remember feeling great satisfaction in knowing that the answers to my algebra and pre-calculus questions were correct. I caught glimpses of beauty in the steps I had taken to arrive at them. I took to computers and the internet like a hen to its nest, clucking my tongue at the old fogies who couldn't grasp the fundamentals of time, usenet, or HTML. Yet if you were to have asked me what I thought of math or science, or whether I was interested in becoming an engineer, a computer scientist, or a doctor, the answer all the way through college would have been an exasperated no. Eager to please, I had cast my lot with the humanities, which provided me the best chance of becoming what every good Christian girl dreamed of, a passing point. To everyone's surprise, I scored higher in math than verbal on my SAT, but nobody looked askance when I decided to pursue a degree in literature and a career in writing. I completed the minimal science and math requirements as quickly as I could and didn't look back. Except, of course, I did.
Jessica here? No? Next up we have Corey Ralston, who is, hang on. Corey Ralston holds a BS in physics from UC Berkeley and a PhD in biophysics from UC Davis. She is currently a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. She has published half a dozen science fiction short stories and is on the editorial staff at the Internet Review of Science Fiction. Please welcome Corey Ralston.
Thank you. My official job title is a mouthful. Staff scientist at the Advanced Light Source Synchrotron at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. My unofficial title is Beamline Scientist. How cool is that? It reminds people vaguely of Star Trek, or at least something futuristic and science fiction-like. I'm one of only three female beamline scientists working at the synchrotron out of a staff of nearly 200. When I was first hired, my even less official job title was Beam Boy, since all the other scientists in my group were male. I lobbied to be called Super Duper Synchrotron Chick, but it never really quite caught on. And Beam Girl just didn't have the same ring to it, so we all simply became Beamline Scientists. Several years ago, I arrived at work to discover the name of the synchrotron had changed. Its usual name is the Advanced Light Source, but that day, a placard in the lobby declared us the Nuclear Biotechnology Institute. It turned out that several scenes from The Incredible Hulk were to be filmed on location at the synchrotron, and its name had to change for a few days. They might as well have called us the Evil Government Facilities. The idea behind the famous comic book story is that the gamma radiation changes Bruce Banner's DNA so much that he morphs into the Hulk when he's angry. The synchrotron does not produce gamma radiation. But if it did, and if we accidentally irradiated someone, which is of course extremely unlikely, the result would be simple, they would die. Not mutate into an angry green giant. The Hulk had to mutate real facts in order to make a good story. But it was confirmation that the synchrotron is fascinating to non-scientists. When Ang Lee wanted a high-tech yet comic book location, he thought of the Advanced Light Source. I love the fact that I can work every day in a place that reminds people of comic books. Here are some of the real experiments we do at the synchrotron. We study the composition of space dust, increase the efficiency of solar cells, we build nanogears out of polymers, we examine electronic and magnetic properties of superconductors, detect contaminants in soil samples, and we image live cells. How did I get to be a girl geek scientist at the synchrotron? It certainly wasn't anything like becoming the mutant hero of a comic book. When I turned 15, one of my birthday presents was a three-volume set of essays about famous mathematicians. There was exactly one essay on a female mathematician, And that essay was all about how hard it was to be a female mathematician. I didn't take physics in high school because it was well known that every year the physics teacher started out his class by telling all the students that boys were simply better at physics than girls. He presented it as a statement of fact. In retrospect, it's strange that no one called him on that. His reputation convinced me not to take his class, but I didn't really dwell on why. I spent my spare time reading science fiction, Heinlein, Asimov, and Bradbury. The fact that most of Heinlein's female characters become hysterical at some point is not... and require a little slapping around by the male characters didn't bother me at the time. The female characters in pre-70s science fiction exist really only to serve the male characters. In 2001, A Space Odyssey, all the flight attendants on the spacecraft are women and wear those short little 60s miniskirts as they serve beverages to the male astronauts. I mean, really. If you can imagine interstellar civilizations with galactic wormhole superhighways, why can't you imagine female astronauts? But none of that bothered me back then. I did what I think most female science fiction fans of my generation did when they were young. I related to the male characters. This mindset helped me through high school. It made me impervious to what other people thought I should do or should like based on my gender. Physics and I finally met in college, and I was love at first sight. Being a fickle but curious girlfriend, I had dated and discarded many other majors before encountering physics. I was with engineering at the time, but cast it callously aside after my first physics class. Physics drew me in with its mystery and its philosophical sophistication. It wasn't just about problem solving and puzzles, which I love, but also about the strangeness of the universe. I mean, how much weirder can you get than relativity? If you travel really fast, your mass increases, you get shorter in one dimension, and time runs slower for you. Just try to wrap your head around that. Physics explores the ultimate mysteries of the universe and uses math to do it. It's geek heaven.
Our next reader is Charlie Anders, who's also a co-editor of the book, and I'm going to sum up her awesome biography here pretty quickly. She's the author of the award-winning novel Choir Boy, and she has also written a manifesto called The Lazy Crossdresser, which is for transgender women struggling with body image, and it's an awesome book. And her writing has appeared in McSweeney's, Salon, The Bay Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, Tycoon, Fresh Yarn, and a whole bunch of other things. But it's exciting to think of, you know, Wall Street Journal being in the same list with things like Punk Planet. And she's also the publisher of Other Magazine, which I'm the editor for. And if you want copies of Other Magazine, you can get some. And there, yeah, and she also runs Writers with Drinks, which is a monthly literary series that we all go to and get drunk and hang out at.
Hey, actually, the next Writers with Drinks is January 10th at the Makeout Room at 7:30. So you all should go.
February
10th. Yeah.
It's actually back in time.
Yeah, because we're so geeky. Okay, so I am a policy wonk. I don't know if anybody actually knows what a policy wonk is. It's sort of a very, even among geeks, it's sort of an obscure and kind of slightly scary thing to be. We're the ones who sort of take simple black and white issues and problems and turn them into sort of horrible, insoluble tangles of facts and studies and options and feasibilities and just generally make the world a more confusing and less comfortable place for everybody. And my particular brand of policy wonk is that I'm a health policy wonk, and I obsess about healthcare reform and outcomes and how to, you know, insure the uninsured and how to save Medicare, yada, yada, yada. So I became a wonk at about the same time that I became a woman, and the two things have sort of always run together for me a little bit. Back when I was a man, I was working as a reporter covering the healthcare industry for a weekly business newspaper. In that job, I fell in love with the jargon and the minutiae of health policy. Broken, messy, and dysfunctional, just like me. The nation's healthcare field held the promise that I would never run out of weird, complicated things to learn. This was the heyday of managed care, and I spent days and days delving into all of its weird permutations. I loved uncovering all these intricate structures that actually matter to everyone.
This particular newspaper, though, like a lot of business weeklies in the late 1990s, was kind of a macho stronghold. Not very many women ever got to be reporters there, and it was all about hard-charging guys chasing hard news. At the time, I was living in the Bible Belt and trying my best to be, if not a manly man, at least not a sprig of parsley. My newfound wonkishness, the pursuit of arcane policy issues, helped to distract me from a nagging discomfort that I couldn't put my finger on. I felt less and less comfortable in my socially assigned gender role as a male reporter. But at the same time, I was acutely aware from my painstaking research that ill-defined symptoms and psychosomatic illnesses cost the U.S. healthcare system millions of dollars every year. My gender discomfort, finally spiked on the same day that my inner palace of wonkdom came crashing down. One day, my editor came over to my little cubicle where I was poring over a rich stack of documents. He bent over my shoulder. "Look," he said, putting his hand on my mouse to break its furious dragging and clicking. "You're wasting our time here." He pointed at my analysis of PPO and HMO growth rates and said, "We don't want any of this what does it mean shit." Right then a bomb went off in my head, just like the cartoon icon that my ancient Macintosh displayed every time I tried to save a document. I tried to defend my love of Arcana, but he just breathed Marlboro-scented condemnation at me until I gave in and promised to stop trying to write what it meant shit. So eventually I sort of got away from there and got a job where I could work from home some of the time and start delving into policy issues. And my new boss not only encouraged wonkiness, he required it. My coworkers got used to me hopping around the office, shouting with excitement about something I had just discovered on page 900 of the latest Federal Register. Every day was like Christmas. And telecommuting 2 days a week meant time to shave my legs and torso, put on a lacy bra, panties, and velvety frock from the big marshals off I-40, and spend the entire day gossiping with sources about different interpretations of the stark physician self-referral laws. So, skipping ahead, fast forward in half a dozen years, I'm legally a woman with a prescription for female hormones and a driver's license that says F. I've delved deeply into the research, into the pros and cons of inflating a balloon inside your spine. I just like saying that sentence. My ambition, though, isn't just to keep working as an interpreter of other people's wonkery. One day, I want to make a serious wonkish contribution to the world. In my sweetest dreams, I use my wonky superpowers to untangle, to advance the causes of feminism and nobody supremacy. Maybe I can help untangle the mess of childcare problems, inadequate health coverage, and faulty gender assumptions that keep so many people trapped in weird no-win situations. I have a feeling if anybody ever solves conundrums like those, it'll be a wonk. So finally, unless Jessica has shown up, finally we have Annalie Newitz, who is a nationally known technology and science writer, who's a contributing editor at Wired, who has also written for a bunch of magazines, including New York Magazine, Popular Science, Salon, New Scientist, The Believer, and a bunch of other magazines with science in the title. And she writes the syndicated column Techsploitation, including in The Bay Guardian. And she's the editor of other magazines. She co-edited the Bad Subjects Anthology and the White Trash Anthology. And please welcome Annalie Newitz.
I'm going to read from my essay, which is called When Diana Prince Takes Off Her Glasses. Diana Prince, for those of you who don't know, is the secret identity of Wonder Woman. And this is sort of, it sort of starts with me when I was young and discovering my geekiness, and then I'll tell you a little bit about my life now. On the suburban lawn outside our condo, I imitate the way Diana Prince becomes Wonder Woman every week on television. I pretend to pull my hair out of a tight bun, take off my imaginary glasses, and spin around until I explode like a star going nova. When the light withdraws, I'm wearing her lasso of truth and her bulletproof bracelets. The glasses have disappeared. For the rest of my life, I find myself thinking occasionally about that transformation. In my 30s, I buy the DVD box sets of the Wonder Woman TV shows to see if the show holds up over time. Unfortunately, the plots are silly, and Wonder Woman's heroism is self-effacing. Oh, Steve, it's just little old me lifting up this tank and rescuing you. Still, the moment when Wonder Woman takes off her glasses is burned into the retinas of my unconscious. She's a geek until she takes them off, but afterward, she's a fantasy. Not because of her super strength and invisible plane, but because she's smart, commanding, and sexually appealing at the same time. As anyone familiar with mainstream U.S. culture knows, such a woman is not supposed to exist. My first lasso of truth is a K-Pro4 with two floppy drives and a tiny green CRT screen. It has a modem, which my friend John explains is for logging into a thing called a BBS, or a computer bulletin board system. He knows a good one called WizNet, where up to a dozen people can chat at the same time. Every night, I log into WizNet and talk until all hours of the morning with people whose bodies are lines of glowing text. I pick a gender-neutral handle, Shockwave Writer. Everyone assumes I'm male, and I don't bother to correct them. I write my first story about high-tech outlaws in high school. It's about my best friends who recently cracked a piece of software. Cracking, in the leet speak of the day, means breaking the copy protection scheme that prevents people from making free copies of the program. I sit with them while they go over dot matrix printouts and get them to teach me about assembly language and how to turn Apple's graphics program MathPaint into something that anybody can download for free. Later, they teach me about freaking, a way of hacking the phone system so you can make free long-distance calls. I sit at my K-Pro for days, composing a tale about geeks who are romantic outlaws, liberating software for the benefit of humanity. My English teacher isn't really crazy about the story, but I gain a reputation among the computer nerds as a strange and unexpected ally. One of the freakers uses a version of my name as a password to his BBS, and I am honored. Although, dictionary word, duh. Anyway, let me just, I'm just going to read one more tiny piece from when I grow up and become a science journalist. And this is actually, this is sort of about how when you are constantly worried that people are underestimating you because you're a woman, that you sometimes just act like a dick. It's 1999, and I'm at a press conference for a company whose business model is to sell services to companies using Linux. I have no idea where this company is now. It probably fell off the NASDAQ with all the rest of the nice Linux companies from that era. I'm talking with another tech journalist, a guy who favors the same cheap engineer's glasses I do, and he's congratulating me on an article I've just published in the San Francisco Chronicle. It's about a group of Linux enthusiasts who spend most of their weekends at trade shows doing install fests. They'll help anyone install and start running Linux on any computer. It's their way of challenging the Microsoft Windows hegemony one box at a time. A primary source in my story is the elusive head of a semi-underground group called the Linux Cabal. So how did you manage to get him to talk to you? The journalist asks, narrowing his eyes. He won't ever talk to me. Maybe I'm paranoid. Maybe I'm sensitive. But suddenly I realize I'm the only woman in the room except for a few marketing droids who look like they were paid mostly to look good in heels and lipstick. And I hear a barb in this guy's query. So I tell him exactly what I think he's implying. I flirted with him. I say, yeah, it's lucky I'm a girl, because guys always want to talk to me. Then I stalk away. To the journalist's credit, he looks confused and a little shaken. Why didn't I just tell the truth? I could have explained that I spent a whole weekend at the trade show sitting at the install fest table and getting to know everybody who came. I watched install after install, saw kids and retirees get excited at the sight of a command line, and I learned the pros and cons of different Linux distributions. I even talked to the gadfly trying to interest people in FreeBSD. I like FreeBSD. I made Cthulhu jokes, and I admitted that Data is my favorite character on Star Trek The Next Generation. I could have said that if you actually go out and pound the pavement and take the time to get to know people, they'll talk to you. I could have explained to him, this is my philosophy of good journalism. But I didn't. A few months later, I do an experiment.
I decide to write an entire article about biotech using only female sources. I call scientist after scientist, getting amazing information about how to compare mouse and human genomes with small number-crunching programs and constantly growing databases of genetic information. Each source refers me to several other top-notch women in the cutting-edge field of computational biology. One builds her own data-mashing computer clusters. Another wrote the software that allows people to browse the fruit fly genome. It's one of the coolest articles I've ever written, and every name in it is female. Q&A, so do all of our female geeks want to come up front? And is there anyone else here who's from the book who wants to come up? And we don't actually know all of you, so okay. So does anybody have questions for any of our geeks?
Yes. I want to thank you because I did the book and a few weeks. It's great now to see the faces, the stories that are written in the book. And I would love to have the stories of the other people, somewhere in the West or somewhere. I was thinking all the other women that were in the school. So we, I don't know if you're thinking of that.
Yeah, I mean, we'd love to do like Return of the Female Geeks or beyond.
At least have it on the web. This is a way of
beyond the
valley. Yeah, well, we encourage the folks who sent us stuff. We'd love to have that because let's talk about it and make it available for everyone. Yeah.
Yeah, we would look to it for sure.
Maybe you should have like a She's Such a Geek carnival.
Yeah,
that would be
a good idea. Yeah.
Cool.
For everyone's answer, do you feel that, say, a 12 or 15-year-old girl today is going to face a similar environment, or is it going to come together a bit?
Actually, sadly, the person who's missing tonight, Jessica, is about 17. So I'm able to answer that question. But her essay is in the book.
I'd say it depends on the field. There's a lot of women in biology now, although they're not the professors, they're not the tenured professors. But in computer science, the percentage of bachelor's degrees going to women peaked in. Anyone know? No, 1984. It's been going down or steady since then. So it really depends on the field.
Well, you know, I mean, in a way, I kind of think that Larry Summers did women in science a favor by being a real jerk 2 years ago. He started this dialogue saying, because I think, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, when, you know, I was starting to head in that direction of geekhood, it was just like, hey, women can do anything. And there was no acknowledgement that there are some other factors that make a geek lifestyle easier for men than for others. Like, I have some friends who are geeks, and they keep on talking about how, you know, I need a wife. You know, they're unmarried, and they've got these high-powered careers, and they don't have anybody to take care of, you know, to cook dinner or anything like that. And I know there's a lot of, you know, geek couples out there, but, you know, just issues of childcare and atmosphere, those are finally being discussed, you know, thanks to Larry Summers. So.
Yeah, adding on to the Larry Summers thing, I think in some ways it's harder, it's more subtle, and it's easier, I mean, it's easy to say, you know, something like what he did was pretty outrageous, but most of it's not.
What's Larry Summers thing? Yeah. What's Larry Summers thing? I don't understand that.
Oh, Lawrence Summers, who was the president of Harvard.
Ex-president.
He was the president of Harvard, and in trying to explain why there are so few women in certain fields, he was saying that basically there's just fewer women at the tail ends of the Gaussian distributions that you have to be at, you know, the super elite scientists. And also there's just, you know, he also claimed that there's, you know, women don't want to put as much up, you know, the 80-hour weeks that it takes to become, say, a tenured professor of physics at Harvard. But, you know, he said, but I don't think there's any sexism going on.
He also did actually speculate that, in fact, there might be a difference in aptitudes between their women's brains and men's brains, and that might account for why there's fewer women in math and science. So he made a number of controversial claims that, you know, and this was at a conference on women in science that he
Well, I don't think that's the full story. The faculty already hadn't liked him. It was the last straw in the offensive things he's done in his career.
I don't mean to claim that that's the only offensive thing he ever did. He has a whole history of offensiveness. But since then, it is true there's been a lot of money that's gone into looking into these questions about why women are underrepresented in science and technology. It is not as true in other parts of the world.
The gender gap isn't as big.
And even within the United States, some studies have shown that the gender gap is greatest among white people. So white women tend to lag behind white men more. And so that sounds kind of cultural to me.
I remember being at a talk when I was an undergraduate at Princeton, and there was an Italian woman physicist who said, oh, it's much more equitable. You know, there's many more, you know, proportionally many more women in physics in Italy than there are here.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a new synchrotron being built in Italy, and half the staff were female.
Yeah. So it's much more equitable in other countries.
Yeah, even in developing countries like India, like the gender gap isn't that big among educated women. I mean, like, Indian men are much more comfortable with science and technology than women because they grew up in mothers and sisters.
I'd have to agree with
that. It's not a big deal. I mean, it's interesting because it's considered to be a developing country, backward, all that stuff.
If you go some places as banal as Toys R Us, you get on the boys' toy section, and there's all these things that just promote creativity. And if you walk down the girls' section, it's nothing but pink on either side.
You can be very creative with dolls.
Yes, there is a history of dolls. I'm doing strange engineering with dolls. But yeah, I
mean,
I think that's right. I think in the United States, there is still a very gender-segregated culture.
Yeah?
Yeah, sorry.
Mm-hmm. So I've been teaching at Technical College, and I've become obsessed with the photos of the graduating classes that are on the walls. And it goes from the 1890-something all the way through to today. And if you walk down the halls, 1890 to about 1940, is half women, half men, or so. 1950s, all men. 1960s, 70s, 80s, a few women here and there, and now maybe a third women. And I have a theory that it has to do with the men going away to war in World War II. And I sort of wonder if maybe that has something to do with now how much harder it is for women to become much more technical in those fields. I don't know. It's just one of those things that I've been obsessing over recently. But, I don't know if you... And that isn't exactly a question, but...
I should actually comment to that. I just had a classmate recently where in World War II, they were using women more in research and development with Russia, so it was like, we must harness these brains of these women to... But then they were developing them to become teachers and not necessarily scientists. So, that's my 2 bits.
Well, you also have to remember that computers were women, right? So, that's like how it kind of, I mean, people who crunch numbers were women during wartime, so I don't know what that means.
Yeah, the work for people who were basically doing programming in the 40s and 50s with computers, they were all women. There's some great histories that have been written of the women who were involved in early computing in the United States. I think that was probably partly because of the war and partly because the work was viewed as menial because it was punching buttons. And also at that time, nobody knew if computers were really going to become a big deal, so maybe it was okay for like the chicks to.
Do you feel like attitudes among men have shifted in all of your experiences in terms of being more positive or negative in various situations?
I do, actually. I work with a lot of students, and the male students I work with are. They definitely are more, I think, accepting than the student when I was a student. They seem to have no problem at all working with female supervisors and learning from female scientists. It doesn't seem to be an issue for a lot of them. That's helpful.
and something that's not an actual change, but a change in perspective. My mom was totally wrong when she thought going into computer science wouldn't be a great way to be a man. And for a long time I've been threatened to, and recently I started projecting pictures of some male computer scientists when I speak to high school girls and say, yeah, there may be some guys who won't like you, but they're probably not who beat their wives.
Why do you project their pictures?
Well, there was this calendar, calendar that was done at University of Washington, the man at Steve Hall, the computer science, and there's some men who are really good looking. And, you know, the girls are surprised. These are computer scientists. Yeah, I know him. He's a great cook, and he makes lots of money.
Okay, so I'm saying this as a humanities guy, but some of it's coming together for me. There's still a disconnect because I think of the geek culture as having been insular, maybe totally male-dominated, but kind of insular and always feeling outside, like outside the male sort of jock mainstream, the, you know, business mainstream, all of these other male culture mainstream. So why isn't geek culture from the beginning more of like a clean slate in terms of gender because of, you know, because there hadn't been this carryover of a sort of like masculine culture into geek culture?
That's something that I've wondered about a lot myself. And I think, I mean, from my experience, you know, growing up in geek culture and being in it now, I think what happened to a lot of boys who grew up as geeks and were called fag, whether rightly or wrongly, as children and were ostracized, is that instead of creating cultures that might be more welcome to women or queers or things like that, a lot of them, not all of them, but many of them reacted by creating an even more macho culture, especially within engineering, but also in some of the sciences. And if you look at sort of how geek culture works in technology, there is a lot of dick measuring, there's a lot of jockeying for position, there's a lot of, even the language that's used, I find so fascinating when people are breaking into computers. I mean, people talk about like popping your chair in the machine and like, you know, penetration testing, and you know what I mean? It's sort of a cheap shot to say that, but like it really is part of the whole slang that you like, you know, you basically like fuck the ass of your computer when you get into it, or actually it should be someone else's computer. You don't want to fuck your own computer. You know, I actually may talk to a lot of hackers, and that really is kind of the language that's used. And so, and of course, computers are boxes, and we all know they're boxes. And so, so I think that there has been that kind of reactiveness, like, okay, well, the jocks picked on us, but now we're our own macho enclave. But I do think that is changing. I mean, you know, sort of that said, I think that there is, that a lot of the men involved in these fields want more women there. And I think what's missing is just networking, and that men, that these men have a lot of friends who are men, and they don't have friends who are women, and that if they did have more friends who were women, there would be sort of more women in these geek cultures, and that's all we're really missing, is kind of bridges of friendship.
One of the things, too, I think, is that women don't get the same sort of kudos for being a geek that men do. If you're a male and you're a geek, you're still important, and at least you're smart. You know, whereas women are more judged on how they look, you know, often. And in our culture, that's how you value women a lot of times, but is their physical appearance. And so when they become a geek, and it's like, so they're smart, well, it's like they don't really get the same sort of treatment outside the geek world.
Okay, so an outsider within the geek world as well as in the real world.
I've been very, you know, my perception of what is geek kind of comes from the 50s science fiction and the massive production that came after that. And but what do you think about the notion of, you know, geek is evolving, and how is it, how is what you are as a geek, how is that, how do you see that changing in the future? Down the line.
Well, I think the fact that I am up here says that it's changing. I mean, I'm not a physicist, I'm not a scientist, I'm a writer. But because I have a passion for these subjects, I'm a geek. And I do think it is starting to stretch and evolve. And I think that part of the fact is just technology and these things that we're talking about are becoming more ubiquitous, and that in itself opens the door to more people to come in and sort of claim that geekness. And I think it's become more acceptable to be a geek. We have so, I mean, it's such, who doesn't, it used to be in the 50s, you mean, it's like, it's kind of a particular set. I mean, not everyone's dad went to work and had a giant computer there. And now, it's everyone actually partakes in things that were traditionally geek territory. From, you know, just early, you know, chat rooms. I mean, everyone's in a chat room now. So I think, you know, I think the definition is broadening and changing from.
Kind of going along those lines, like, I guess I want to know what exactly is a geek in the sense of, is it specifically defined to the sciences? Or, I mean, when I think of geek, I think of, like, library science geeks.
We actually did. Were you here at the start? We talked about how we chose to define geek for the purposes of this book.
Oh, I was a fan.
Sorry, we actually did. We were very sad because we did have a bunch of librarians who submitted essays. There was like a huge, there was a contingent, and
we want to do librarian
work later. Library sciences are not traditionally male dominated. In fact, it's been a kind of female-dominated field quite traditionally for a very long time. And so we didn't include that because we were really trying to focus on sort of the geek, the areas in culture where when people think of the stereotype of who's in them, they think of a guy. So it's like computer nerd or physics nerd or science fiction geek or, gamer or... Or comic books. We have a comic book writer in the book. And so that was kind of how we did it, was to think of places where there were very few examples of female geeks.
Lauren?
Yeah. Back in the 80s, I was a computer programmer, contractor. And most of the agencies I worked for were run by women and dominated by women. And several women were single mothers, and they said that this was the best business to be in because you made the most money per hour and it had the most flexible hours. So you build your schedule any way you wanted. I don't think that's true anymore. I think that crumbled, but for a time it was sort of a beautiful time. It was a good field to be in. And I think basically the corporations just sort of found out that there were some people having a good time and crushed it.
Well,
I disagree on that one.
So
it's a great place to be, to work from home, to drown hours, to make good money.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I think
doing
it does.
What are you doing?
What?
Doing what? Like
programming?
Cool.
Yeah, I think it depends on where you work.
First, I found your story is really powerful and just wonderful. I'm wondering, at first I'd like to invite you to come to Google and maybe do something similar to this, and then also maybe discuss with the folks at Google how we might be able to help get this message out more broadly via YouTube, maybe perhaps, or something like that, promoting it a little bit more, because I think a lot of high school girls, if they heard this message, or even younger, heard these stories, but it would kind of inspire them more. So I'm just wondering how you can get that word out more to a broader audience, perhaps.
There is actually a video of our first reading from the book, which is on the WGBH, it's the local PBS station in Boston, on their website. They did a video, and it came out pretty good, and we can send you the link to that if you give us your info. But we would love to come and do something at Google. That would rock. We have a Google person in our midst.
That's how some Googlers here found out.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Yeah, that would rock. Synergy. Okay. Well, maybe like one more question?
Okay.
Yes? Yeah, well, just out of curiosity,
Are any of you into pro sports or know women geeks who enjoy pro sports? Well, except for baseball. I mean,
pro sports.
Except
yeah.
for baseball.
Baseball is like an atheist sport.
Sounds like a personal.
I used to go watch the women's basketball. That was awesome. Because yeah. like they were all queer and they were really like good at it, and they weren't just. It was awesome.
Actually,
Stanford
is the best team.
Yeah. Women's basketball rules.
I have to say, more than the geek culture, the most like weird genderized moment of my entire life was when I was a college reporter going to a football game with another reporter, and I walk into the reporter booth, and it was like every head went, what is she doing here? And they're all just jumping. Right. I was the only woman, and that's the only time I've ever actually experienced that feeling of being the only one in the room was in sports.
But I have heard people talk about how kind of being a jock and being a geek kind of went together for them. I mean, I've heard women talk about that, and in fact, there are a couple essays in the book where women talk about like how they did various sports, and that kind of prepared them for the endurance required to do, say, computer programming all night.
Yeah. So, in fact, Jessica, who was supposed to be here, is a wrestler, and she, people question her geekhood, she just kind of beats them up.
It's the next generation. I think there is some overlap, and then but then of course there's also the fact that, the geeks and the jocks tend to be kind of separate. just like Revenge of the Nerds, but the nerds win, so I guess that's good. All right, well, thanks very much for coming out, and we'll find you.